Now, the shotgun start in golf is full of mathematics. There's a lot of setup work that we have to do in order to make a tournament work. So I'm going to demonstrate to you just exactly how we do a shotgun start here.
And here we go.
All right, all right, all right. Gentlemen, start your engine!
Greetings and welcome to a Friday edition of the Shotgun Start. It is May 6th. Andy, how are we doing?
Brendan, I'm doing wonderful. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Happy May the 6th. May the 6th be with you.
We're here.
We got through Star Wars Day, barely. I mean, as soon as I talked about that openly, I was getting hammered with texts and everybody's screenshotting the emails from different co-workers that they got at their places of employment about May the 4th be with you. But we're through it. We got through it. We're on May the 6th now. Weekend ahead.
What? You know, there is a big news. Big news. Leishman is using all parts of the field today.
I have not watched this video. He hit a cold shank, a hard shank. At
out
TPC
of a bunker.
Baton.
Yeah, he was just shooting one down the right field line, you know? Almost took out Corey Connors, but that's you got to be aware when you're on the hot corner.
He's guarding the line. Had he been off the bag, he might have taken one off the dome, huh? I'm playing more off the bag. He might have taken one up there. All right. Well, that's good. That's good. You love it when you have that kind of skill to control the bat and send it to all directions and at all velocity. You know, that's what you could do. Work it both ways. All right. Breaking news. That's good. I'm glad we got there. I have other breaking news. Shocking. According to SI.com, Greg Norman was officially denied his special exemption request into the Open Championship, or the British Open, as it's known. I know that will stun people to hear that Norman was not allowed to play.
Unbelievable, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of...
I feel like he's been disrespected. I hope that...
Disrespect.
You know, he's disrespected when he wrote that letter for Tiger. I hope we get an email to the Open Championship that starts, "Surely you jest."
Surely you jest. a lot of happenings. So this is going to be a little different Friday episode. We have an interview with Shane Ryan, author of a book coming out next week on the Ryder
Cup.
Really
a flashback Friday.
It is a flashback Friday.
His new book.
We're going to shoehorn that in. Don't worry about that. Good friends at Precision Pro. Our great friends at Precision Pro. We're not timely in responding to email, but we are enthusiastic about e-meeting, you know, when we do. But
we had
a good
e-meet with them.
This is kind of just happening weekly now, right? The PGL, you know, writing open letters. People talking about requesting releases for the Saudi part of it. We've got, you know, Norman just is weekly like news making item, right? He pops in and out talking about how much money they've lost. It's just like consuming the game, right? I was thinking about this the other day, and I'm going to save this for another time. It's an evergreen take. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it another time.
How are you going to do that? How are you going to do that to me? How are you going to do that to the people?
I think the Netflix series, there has to be a Phil Mickelson episode. An entire Phil Mickelson episode. He hasn't agreed to do the show, but if you don't have the people in golf talking about Phil, and this is the point of the take. He's dominated the season more than anyone else without playing, really. Without playing. He has owned this entire golf season.
Are you saying he's at the top of the PIP rankings?
No, I'm not. I'm just saying the way we've thought about this golf season has little to do with actual golf. I'm not saying he's not the entire season, but, you know, he's been the most prominent, I would say, story of this year. So I was wondering, like, how can you tell the story of golf in 2022 season without a Phil Mickelson episode? Anyways, that's my take. So it relates to sort of another week, another round of stuff here. Your boy Westy kind of walking right into it. Excellent questioning. I think it was Jamie Weir of Sky who, you know, I watched it. They didn't identify him. Sounded like him. And he chimed in that he was doing the interview. sort of not letting West, not, you know, not confronting him, but just not letting Westy regurgitate the usual bullshit line and say, like, you know, just because the F1 goes there, I mean, you could argue two wrongs don't make a right. A very fair follow-up question. And Westy walks right into, like, well, they're, Saudi knows they've got issues and they're trying to get better through sport, which is, like, honestly, like, the rote almost definition of what they're trying to do with the sports washing. So tough times on Westy Island. He's asked for a release. Dick Bland's asked for a release, which just comes as no surprise.
Can we talk about the Westy thing a little bit?
What, are you going to try and rationalize it, like his drop, his crooked drop at DPC Sawgrass last year?
Not rationalizing anything anymore.
Uh-huh.
This is the pitfalls of when, you know, he famously talked about having never read a book. Like, that's been something that's, like, trumpeted.
Who shared that with us? A guest, someone in Grantland. It's in a Grantland interview, I feel like.
Said, yeah.
Never. All right.
It's like one of his, like, he carries it as a badge of honor. And I'm just going to say this, that
KBB, I think, said that.
He got outsmarted here in this interview. He got walked down the plank. He literally, it was like a... like he was blindfolded and he didn't know where he was going. And the person, Jamie Weir, just walked him right into where he wanted to go. And Westy was too dumb to even know where he was going. And, I mean, Jamie Weir, excellent interview, just got him right to where he wanted. Got him to say exactly what you wanted him to say. Which is like, hey,
we're sports washing.
We're sports washing.
We get a lot of money. So we're getting the talking points here, the next round of talking points. Independent contractor deal was one he hit on. That other things are happening there. Snooker and darts. Or snooker, dots. He did at one point called it me job. It's me job. So those are the talking points.
It's a sad day on Westy Island. Homeowners have no value. It's over.
The real estate prices have tanked.
We had our run. It's over. It's just an oil field. It's just a barren wasteland. It's a desert. There's no great fruits. There's nothing left. It's over.
Uninhabitable? Uninhabitable?
It is. It's been devastated. It's been
leveled.
Anything
else on the Saudi stuff? Did you read that PGL memo that they had everybody...
Now, talk about an organization operating from a position of no leverage. Like, talk about just a feeble plea, an open letter, a feeble plea for some relevance. I do sympathize a little bit where, you know, there's this backlash about the Saudis being involved. A small part, that's the thing, is now when we go back and re-look, like... Oh, God, I would be just thrilled if the Saudis were just a small part of this whole thing. And, you know, they go back to the drawing board because of that. And the Saudis just steal their idea, you know. And this is like a thing when you're trying to do an entrepreneurial thing or your startup. Like, you know, when you're a small startup and just starting, the thing that you're worried the most about is somebody stealing your idea. And the Saudis did that. And now it's just a fledgling... organization that's trying to have some relevance in the game.
Yeah, trying to get their message out there any way they can. I think, like, I don't know the guys involved really, but it feels like we have maybe guys with expertise and sort of intelligence, but no cash or no sort of momentum. They have some cash, I guess. And then, like, the guys with all the cash, and pardon my French, just a bunch of chuckle fucks. With like hanging around doing all this, like honestly with the more money to just step on their you know what over and over again and still succeed. It's kind of interesting how like that just the money and the sort of operational intelligence, and this is not have not lined up. This is not to say anything of sort of the source of money. It just nothing's come together to make this sort of appealing when we're not opposed to some sort of upstart challenging
the
tour
thing.
For sure. So
the thing is when here's Here's the reality. In a way, golf has made its bed with the Saudis because of the backlash it had to the original PGL, which there was some Saudi influence in it, but it was more of a, you know, it was more of a setup where it was similar to the way, you know, F1 racing is, where the Saudis are a part of it, but yeah, they are not the whole thing.
Yeah.
And because golf reacted the way they did to it, we now have made this bed of where we have just the pure Saudi product.
Yep.
All right, just said, shit, we're just doing it on our own. And it just, that's the thing that you said it so eloquently there. The chuckle fucks.
I mean, this is everything you hear about the people. Like, this isn't even the people writing Norman. This is just everybody. It's just, I don't know. Not a lot.
So, do you think we should apply for media credentials now or later for the events?
I don't know. We probably need to get it out there now. You could, you know, get on the road, start driving out to Dick Harvest Farms, and you know, watch that whatever event it is. Like in June, July, whatever. That's September. I don't remember where that is. I don't know. I'm sure we'll have more on this on Monday. More guys will ask for releases. No one, you know, I don't know who we have confirmed. Mickelson, Westy, Dick Bland, and that's about it. Can I have a separate tangent here? Who asked for a Robert Allenby rehabilitation tour? Why is he getting articles about his, you know,
After the Australian outlets.
Oh, is that where? I saw it in the New York Post. Maybe they aggregated it.
You just keep popping the Aussies.
I see it aggregated by Mark Sanchez. I don't know if that's the quarterback written at the New York Post.
After all the negative articles the New York Post wrote about Mark Sanchez, he's now writing for him.
Oh, it's Evan Priest. Okay. All right. I see. Although, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know that Robert Allenby needed the floor again. I don't think he needed, not that, you know, I'm not trying to cancel anybody or, you know, mute somebody out, but I just don't think he needed a rehabilitation tour. Anyways, to be shocked to know that what happened is still a mystery to him. They're still out there trying to find the guys who you know what? Abducted him.
Guess you what happens when you black out? It remains a mystery to you forever. You can be told by friends what happened, but still the clarity of the situation as you remember other events in your life remain a mystery. That is at the very core basis what blacking out means.
He's got to regret taking that selfie, sending it around. It's on every article. Like, it just lives on it. Like, he shared that willingly. That selfie. I'm just looking at it now. Still.
That's a man right. Not understanding how social media works. Yeah. And how the internet works. And how if you post something, it never goes away.
Oh, all right. Anything else you want to get to? Rory talked about the fall.
I did not expect to talk about Allenby today.
Well, you can never get enough Allenby. Rory McIlroy speaking at the Wells Fargo Championship. I don't know. What do you say about the fall schedule? Basically, it wouldn't be popular amongst the rest of my
life. I just was reliving a blackout. I blacked out at my bachelor party. I passed out on my best friend's floor.
Okay.
And, you know, I apparently threw up in an Uber. I've never thrown up in an Uber.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
I don't know any, you know, this is all news
to me.
Why
are we sharing this? Okay.
But this is the thing, is that I don't know any of the details. I don't know what happened. I've been still told this happened, but I don't know. Much like Robert Allenby, I don't know what happened. Like, I cannot tell you exactly what happened.
Well, as long as your face was in, you know,
I was fine.
Unharmed. That's good.
I had a bad hangover. But anyways, on to Rory in the fall.
Wait, do you have any actual salient points about the PGL memo outside of their like grasping at straws? Like, it's the same model we've heard them talk about.
I mean, this is just
players can own part of it and I mean, it uses the term bullshit in there. It says, like, you know, Rory getting the, you know, sending it to Allen and Company for an actual, I don't know what they did, like profitability.
An audit, study, effectively. A model.
Yeah. It was like,
how about Allen and Co. getting a free ad? Do you think the tour has shook them down to be some sort of official partner? I don't know if I've ever seen them on the official partner list.
The tour official partner list is growing. These press releases I get for, like, the official, like, it has nothing to do with golf. Anyways, yeah, Allen and Company did an audit.
Allen Investments.
PGA Tour welcomes Dreamfinder Homes as an official marketing partner. What does that mean? What does that mean?
I don't
Dreamfinder's Homes. What's that getting us?
It's Jacksonville company.
Well, of course it is. Of course it is.
I don't understand what this is. Is this like a? Are they trying to fight with Zillow?
PGA Tour and Quintar expand augmented reality relationship. What does that mean?
What are we doing right now?
I don't know. We're bouncing around.
Why are we talking about this?
We have an interview to do with do you have Rory thoughts on Rory's fall schedule? He kind of popped the entire membership. He's like, the fall schedule shouldn't exist.
He just illuminates all the issues with the PGA Tour.
Yeah.
Like, he effectively says, should the fall exist? No.
It's hard. It's very hard for me to stand here and say I'd like all the fall events to go away and play 3 or 4 of these suggested tournaments that they're thinking about, because that's good for me, but that's not good for the entire membership. So I have to try to look at things that are not going to benefit that are going to benefit the entire membership and the entire tour, and not just what benefits me or the top players. Huh. All right.
You know what that was code for? I got to look out for Kelly Kraft.
Does he, though? Does he have to? I guess he does in his position of pack.
See, the thing is that the best thing he could do for golf would be not to look out. This is the thing. He's the president, or whatever the hell the position's called.
The chairman of
the pack. He's the chairman of the players. He's not the chairman of golf. And this is the thing. This is why, you know, this is why committees at country clubs that make fucking terrible decisions. It's why boards at park boards and municipalities make awful decisions. Is because they're looking out for all these other constituents and not just golf as a whole. And that's the thing I will say on the back half of the PGL thing. I think there's merits to the PGL and like what they could bring golf. Like idea of this format. Yeah. I don't know if I'm crazy about it, but I'm interested to see how it would work. I'm not interested to see how it works with the Saudis at the helm. But like, this is the thing. It's like the PGL is bad for the membership of the PGA Tour. And that's why they're probably frustrated. This kind of goes hand in hand with Rory's comments about the fall.
Yeah.
You know, and the PGA Tour is looking out for their status quo. It's looking out for members 75 through 125, which sucks for golf fans. It's why we have it's why we have back to back weeks with two players in the top 20. Two players
over there. Great event.
When you legitimately think about it, they can't even put a top 10 player in the morning wave. And the afternoon wave. We can't get a top 10 player playing in TV coverage on Thursday and Friday. I was thinking about this when I was driving the other day. It's like, how messed up is that? That they don't have a top 10 player to put in each of the TV windows. That's a joke. And this is the problem with the PGA Tour.
Yep. Not great. Anything else you want to hit on before we get to Shane Ryan?
You want to back to Robert Allenby?
You want to do 18-hole leaderboards? Matthew Wolf, Denny McCarthy.
Oh, I do want to talk about Matthew Wolf.
Rockville Zone, Denny McCarthy. Home game. Could be the biggest home win since LeBron won for the Cavs. Okay, go ahead. What do you got?
I saw Daniel Rappaport tweeted out some quotes from Matthew Wolf, and it's just crazy. The mental health thing is nuts.
Is nuts. The mental health thing is nuts. Yeah.
I'm not saying this very eloquently.
Significant. Yeah.
But we're talking about a guy that like, and I think this is like one of the difficulties of pro golf, and especially in tennis, like tennis, it's been something that has been really prevalent. Individual sports are really, really hard.
Yeah.
Like they're really hard. And I think when you look at Matthew Wolf, like his quotes were effectively to the point, I'm not here to win. I'm here to have fun. Like I'm realizing that my mood, and this is the thing, is like we've seen this at tournaments. My mood's impacting not only me, but the people I'm with and the players I'm playing with in my group. You know, there he was getting consoled at the Masters, like around the golf course. And this is serious stuff, mental health. Like mental health is legit, and it's magnified when you're in a individual competition. And I think when I think about Matthew Wolf, this might have happened whether or not, you know, we did, you know, but like there were such lofty expectations placed on Matthew Wolf from the moment he turned professional, really before he turned professional.
Yeah, I'd say from the moment like Oklahoma State, like it's while he was still there.
And this is always like just as golf fans, as golf, right? Like it's a big part of being a professional is being a professional and being able to handle life as a professional and the expectations that come with it. And I think like it's just something that I'll remember of it. And as like, you know, just be careful about putting too much expectation on somebody before they've really done anything, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, it's like anything, you know, it's like when you hire somebody for a new job is having, you know, like you're going to know what is going on 3 months later. And it's probably like they're going to be better at things or they're going to be, you know, better at things that in that you didn't even think that they could do, you know, is a lot of times what I've found. It's like, wow, you know, I didn't even know how good this person would be at this, you know? And it's in the sense of that, like, I think like that's the hard thing. And I think we're only going more this path with how young the tour is getting. Mm-hmm. And we just have to be careful before they do it for a sustained period. I mean, you could pull up so many articles about Matthew Wolf changing golf.
What was the reality show? I can't think of it. The college reality show on Golf Channel. Remember they did like try to do
Ricky's
Hard Knocks
show.
And yeah, driving, drive on.
I feel like it was drive. It wasn't drive to survive. It was God, what
something
was
with
it?
Drive in it. So I think, I don't know. But yeah, that's like where it really became, I mean, I wouldn't say that was like an insanely popular show, but larger golf audience really got exposed to him even there.
And here's the thing. I bag on 75 through 125 all the time. But those guys that are there consistently are pros, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and that, I think it's hard to be a professional golfer. It's really hard. And we underrate how challenging the game is to play at a high level as a professional and because of the mental aspect. And I think Matthew Wolf, like, I really hope he like succeeds and does well, but it sucks seeing him at this spot, but I hope he's on the right path out.
Yeah. Yeah. This seems like somebody would, you know, we want to succeed. I mean, we don't want anyone to fail, but we certainly golf would be better with Matthew Wolf prominently playing well. All right, let's do an ad read for our friends at Precision Pro Golf. This is Flashback Friday. It features an interview with Shane Ryan in which things from the past are discussed, namely 1983 Ryder Cup, 2016 Ryder Cup. There's a lot of discussion about the future and like future villains. And we're trying to pepper him with conspiracy theories about the PGA Tour.
Listen, I don't know how much we talked about his book. We did talk a lot about a lot of amusing things, but I think I'm excited for it. I don't have it yet. I'm not a crooked advanced copy media person.
That's not true. It's being sent to you. We are crooked, but we're not crooked
I'm
in lying that
to
we
read it.
All these interviews you hear with authors, like, oh, I read the book. It's great. And there's no way these people read these books before they do all these interviews. I think that's bullshit.
That's the thing. Yeah. I haven't
read
it.
We'll be honest. We have not read it. But
I do.
I'm excited to read it.
I will say anybody that has not gotten Shane's Slaying the Tiger, that I read that before I was ever in golf media, and I thought that was enthralling. That was when I was, you know, quintessential casual golf fan. I read that and I loved, I like that, you know, I'm not a huge reader. I'm more of Westy than, you know, I am of
than Troy Merritt.
Yeah. I read like a book a year, legitimately, maybe two, maybe three, depends on, you know, but anyways, that is a book that I read cover to cover. When I get into a book, I really get into it. And I got into that one. So if it's anything like that,
Precision Pro.
Oh yeah, I forgot about it. We're on Shane Ryan's.
So anyways, the point is we discuss things from the past with Shane. So this will serve as Flashback Friday. And the sponsor of Flashback Friday all year.
Double ad read.
Is Precision Pro Golf. And you can go to that URL, precisionprogolf.com. Use the promo code SHOTGUN20. You get $20 off an NX9 rangefinder. I was playing with the No Lane Up boys at Media Day on Monday. They were shooting their guy, you know, had their guys up and out. And you know, they're big Precision Pro folks. We had a call with Precision Pro today. Just a wonderful, wonderful gent named Nick. They're, you know, coming in, helping us around the U.S. Open. They supported the podcast, supported a lot of hopefully like, you know, independent golf media types that you guys out there like. So we can support them. If you need a range finder, go to precisionprogolf.com. You know, it's they figured out how to thread the needle with value, right? You're not playing an arm and a leg. For a quality product. So, and it's a free lifetime battery replacement. I like
great.
That.
I had a caddy at the country club, my guy Piero. He had the Precision Pro. I felt at home.
He did?
Yeah.
Uh-oh. I like it. All right. So go to precisionprogolf.com, use promo code SHOTGUN20. Let's get to our interview with Shane Ryan. You'll get all the details about the book. I'm going to say this was a good one. You always pop me for saying this was a good, like before people have listened. I'm not saying I was good or you were good, but Shane is entertaining and insightful. All right, let's get to him. All right, we now welcome in Shane Ryan. He is a writer at Golf Digest, a golf media personality, savant, expert of some sort, a Ryder Cup enthusiast and chronicler. And he joins us now to talk about his new book. We've been following his golf writing and work for not quite a decade, but I think almost a decade here. He joins us now. He's got a new book on the Ryder Cup coming out. Shane, thank you for joining us. Tell us about the book, its title, and where we can get it.
Yeah, thank you, guys. The book is titled The Cup They Couldn't Lose. It is the story of the Whistling Straits Ryder Cup, but also kind of the story of the modern Ryder Cup in general, starting in the 80s when Europe started to really dominate. So it's a story of how Europe became so good, and then it's the story of how America figured it out, really. And that second story culminates, obviously, in Whistling Straits with that huge blowout. So, yeah, you know, you can get it at all the normal book places, basically. You can, depending on, you know, what your morals are, you can get it at Amazon, you can get it at Hachette, you can get it at Barnes & Noble, or whatever variety of indie booksellers there are.
Conglomerate.
Is it gonna be at all the indie bookstores? Can I go into, you know, a bookstore in a random town and say I want Shane Ryan's book and they're gonna have it?
You wouldn't believe the demand I'm getting for this book from indie bookstores just in like Portland, Oregon. Portland, it's insane how many books Portland, Oregon has ordered. Yeah, you know how indie bookstores are with golf books, man. They load up. That's how they make their money. So
all right, the cup they couldn't lose is the title. It will be out Tuesday. I don't know when we're publishing this, but Tuesday, is that right?
May 10th. Okay. It'll be out. Yeah.
And you can pre-order it, I assume, at some of the large shops.
Pre-order too, right?
You can totally pre-order it. Yep. Okay. I insisted on that with the publisher.
Wonder of technology.
I said, I need pre-orders for this baby. And they obliged. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Fantastic. Shane, thank you for joining us. So,
I got a question.
Go ahead.
Aloud. In this, you know, this world of golf that we live in, sure, oftentimes monetary rewards are crammed down our throats as to, you know, what the intrigue of a week-to-week thing. In your opinion, just in general with the Ryder Cup, how is this $0 exhibition match come to captivate the world of golf for, you know, effectively a Ryder Cup year, an entire year, the subplot storyline is the Ryder Cup, and then the week of it becomes, you know, arguably the biggest spectacle in golf for the year. I think I compare the Masters as kind of the annual Kentucky Derby of golf,
yeah,
where it rises to the, you know, forefront of all of sports. But the Ryder Cup, I think, is the other event that does that as well.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the coolest stories in sports, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, because if you go back to, you know, this used to be, it started in 1927, but it used to be the U.S. versus the U.K., and there were 50 years where the U.S. almost never lost, I think lost one time in 57 years or something. So you go back to 1981, right after they basically brought in all of Europe to try to make this thing more competitive. In 79 and 81, it was the European team, and the U.S. still just completely destroyed them. And so there was a point before Tony Jacklin took over, this British golfer who became kind of their George Washington figure who turned things around. But there was a point before that where it really, really seemed like the Ryder Cup was going to die. Absolutely nobody cared about it, had no interest in the U.S. especially. And there's kind of this funny story where there was this bank, the Sun Alliance Bank, that sponsored it on the European side. And the only reason they sponsored it is because the owner was a friend of the prime minister. And the prime minister was kind of like, it's your national patriotic duty to like sponsor the Ryder Cup and keep it going. And then after 1981, he was like, this is stupid. I'm no longer doing this. I don't care like what anybody says. It's a bad event. Like Europe, you know, Europe can never win. So he backed out. And at the time, the British PGA and the sort of fledgling European Tour were desperately looking for sponsors. And they did for 2 years and couldn't find anything. There was this guy, Colin Snape, who was their executive secretary. And he came back to his board after all this huge hunt. And all he had was this offer for cigarette coupons that were redeemable. Like that was going to be the sponsor of the Ryder Cup. And they were like, we can't do that because we don't want cigarettes associated with the event. So that doesn't work. So we've got nothing. And so he had this like desperate last minute trip where he went up to Perth, Scotland to meet with this company called Bell's Scotch Whiskey. And just out of nowhere, this dude, Raymond McKell, who owned Bell's, was like, yeah, I'm going to give you £300,000. I want to sponsor it, not just for 83, but I want to sponsor it for 83, which was in the US, and I want to sponsor it for 85. So they got this last minute infusion of cash. And part of the deal was like Raymond McKell said, I want my name, Bell's Scotch Whiskey, all over everything in America, especially because he wanted to expand his market. And so they had to take that to the PGA of America and try to sell that. And PGA of America, they weren't thrilled, but the European Tour was like, if we don't have this, it's done. Like there's not going to be a Ryder Cup anymore. So they accepted it. Anyway, the Ryder Cup continues and they needed something to change immediately. And the story of how Tony Jacklin transformed this thing from a 50-year massacre into something where Europe all of a sudden was winning and then would go on to win for a couple decades is something I cover really extensively in the book. And, you know, I just think it's like one of those amazing sort of reversal sports stories, period. And to answer your question about, you know, why is this something that has captivated so much? Again, for another decade after Europe started winning, the U.S. didn't care. And only gradually, as the European fans started to win Ryder Cups and they started to kind of be their European selves and have these raucous like cheering sections and everything went crazy. By the time 1991 came, the U.S. golfers were so pissed off at how they were treated in Europe and at having lost a bunch of times that we get to the war by the shore in Kiowa. And the Iraq war was going on at the same time. So there was all this like patriotic vibes going on. And all of a sudden, like the fans showed up, they riled them up and, you know, they were doing things like a local DJ told fans to call the European hotel in the middle of the night to wake them up and rile them. And you had this like crazy, crazy, crazy tense Ryder Cup. NBC had just bought the rights to it. And Dick Ebersol, who was the head of the sports division, was really pissed off as it started going because they didn't have any ratings. He thought this was a terrible event. And then Sunday came and you had this crazy, crazy finish where Bernard Langer missed the putt and gave the U.S. the victory. And suddenly like Jack Welch, the chairman of GE, called him up and said, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. And just basically overnight, it went from something that was still kind of dubious to something that was this really, really dramatic thing that NBC loved so much. And it's just grown ever since until it's the monster that it is now.
You talked about the commercialism of it, or like at least like saving it there. And yeah. Now obviously we know it's big, big, big business. It floats or had floated the European Tour, you know, like every other year it kind of gets them back in the profitability.
Yeah.
Did you, so we have insurances, companies, cars, everything. Like, it looks like one of those soccer matches, like the post, like when, you know, the background where it's like brand. So I assume you dedicated like 50 pages or a couple chapters to the Aeon Nicholas Jacklin Award.
Yeah.
To captivate the current state of the Ryder Cup. Is that what a big chunk of this book is about?
Do you know if DJ still has the plate?
That is a great question. I don't know about that. But yeah, Brendan, to your point, if you like corporate branding and sponsorship details, this is the book for you. It's not just 50 pages. It is hundreds and hundreds of pages of just going into contract details, reprinting contracts in some cases for chapters at a time. Yeah, so that is really my wheelhouse.
We're making up awards. The Aeon Nicholas Jacklin Sportsman, whatever it is. It's just an amazing thing that how it's evolved where they can sort of add on and on. But like Andy said, the sort of the backlash in it, or integrity or core of this being such a howitzer of an event has not changed despite all the money around it.
Yeah.
And the money that's not up for the players hasn't really changed. Why do you think that is in terms of at least the players' motivations and the players' interests and passion for it?
It's pretty funny. They give them a chunk of money that they can use for charity on both sides. But right. This has been a fight in the past. Like the Europeans at one point fought to make more money. Marco Mira, I think, made a remark. But it's kind of funny the way, especially in America, how it works, where if these players ask for more money, the immediate reaction of the fans is to be angry at them. Yeah. And you know, it's like, I think in terms of like the morality of should they get paid, to me, it's very similar to the NCAA. Like, absolutely, they should get paid. Like, these guys are playing this exhibition that brings in an insane amount of money. It's only good because they decide to play, right? If the 12 top Americans didn't play next time, people would watch it, but it wouldn't be nearly as good or profitable, and it would start a slow decline where the Ryder Cup would die. Like, it depends on the buy-in, and they don't get paid for it. It's really, really something where I think, in a strange way, the conservatism of the sport works against them because it's very much a thing of like, oh, these rich divas, they look at them like being greedy and wanting money. And so nobody kind of says it anymore. They just sort of accept whatever, like, extremely modest bit they're, you know, given to give to the charity of their choice, and they go play. And that wouldn't work if it didn't have such status, right? If the Ryder Cup hadn't gained such status over time, that wouldn't be possible. But now it is. And so they're kind of, I don't know what the players think. Honestly, I think they just accept it. Or if they don't, they're kind of handcuffed. They're never going to get paid for this.
At one point,
LIV Golf should start an opposite field event.
At one point, I knew the gown stipend for the significant others, and it was substantial. But like, it was, you know, all things told, of what the thing generates and what the players are receiving. It's not—I forget what it was. I'm going to wildly misquote it, so I don't want to say it. But it was a lot of money for like the wardrobe for the significant other that comes. But yeah, in terms of monetary, you know, inducements, there's very, very few.
Yeah,
I mean, from a commercialization standpoint, it is the most commercialized, maybe outside of the FedEx Cup, which is, you know, a series of events, right? Wouldn't you say that this is the most commercialized event in golf?
It's certainly close, if not the most. And, you know, I spoke a lot with the guys running things at Whistling Straits, and like the guy, Jason Mangle, who is the tournament director, a huge, like really the overwhelming part of his responsibility is filling hospitality suites, keeping these sponsorships. It was a huge headache for him when COVID delayed it because there was a stipulation in their contracts that everyone could just back out, and a lot of them did. So he had to like hustle to like fill those again. But yeah, it is the name of the game is like corporate sponsors, corporate hospitality tents, all that stuff, because it is such a moneymaker and they depend on it, like Brendan was saying, especially in Europe.
Hey, can I, one question, this we'll get back to the book because you're such an expert on this topic. Do you think this is replicable in any way with anything else? The President's Cup is a thing that exists. Was this just total lightning in a bottle, the ascendance of Europe? Like, I think like if any organization could replicate this, they would try.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they are trying. Do you see those efforts out there? What's like do you have an examples of that? And if it's possible, can it be done?
One thing that I brought up in an old podcast I did was, I hope I don't forget the name, but I think I will. Essentially, it was a swimming thing where they said, we're going to do a Ryder Cup, but US versus Australia. We're gonna do, oh, it's like the duel in the pool. That's what it was called. Okay. The duel in the pool. And you're like, that's a really cool idea. I mean, like, Olympic swimming is so much fun. Not that I ever watch swimming outside the Olympics, but that's a blast. And like, that's a, you know, seems like a good idea. And they tried it. And I think the Americans won, you know, like four times in a row. And then the thing, the TV people were just like, this is, we're not going to pay for this anymore. And it kind of died. And yeah, no, I guess like my only point would be like the, I think the Ryder Cup benefited from the fact that when it was 50 years of American blowouts, this was sort of a pre big dollar television era. So they could afford just to do it. Yeah. Okay. It's an exhibition match every 2 years. It's the players probably enjoy traveling, whatever. If that happened now, it would be over. And like the President's Cup would be an interesting example of, we've seen that, right? We've seen America just crush the international team for, I don't know, is it 30 years now? I don't know exactly when it started, but it's getting close to 30 years. And that stays because the PGA Tour, right, is the financial backer of it. And that could get good. Like, that could be a really fun event. I think like the Melbourne one was actually a ton of fun. I was there and I had a good time at it. If the international team started winning, that could be good. But if it were up to its own devices, if it needed, you know, TV profitability and didn't have the PGA Tour behind it, that would be, I think, completely dead by now. So it's very hard.
Hey, this is a segue back to your book here and kind of what happened last year. Is a take I had in the fall was that the President's Cup over the next 20 years is actually going to be more competitive than the Ryder Cup. Do you think, like, you know, obviously everybody likes to make proclamations. We've been in a European era of dominance lately.
Yeah.
Is it now, has it shifted back to where the U.S. is the dominant team? And obviously that would be centered around the topic of your book.
Yeah, I feel like right now you're setting me up for a soundbite that's going to get Rory McIlroy to yell at me after they win in Italy, like he did to Shipnuck, right? Like, so like Shipnuck wrote the glib piece, right? That he was like, America's just going to win. It's over. So I'll say this. I am on record. People can go look it up. I predicted a U.S. like route before Whistling Straits. And the Ryder Cup's interesting in that we learn a lot about how good a captain is afterward. Like, you know, sometimes things come out afterward that we don't know going in. Here's what I think. I think the task force was this big joke. Everybody laughed at it, and they probably should have, because task force is a funny name. I think it was one of the most effective things the U.S. golf could ever have done. I think it really instituted a good system. I think they keep learning from it. I thought Davis Love was a great captain. Furyk got really unlucky in Paris for a couple reasons, but then Stricker was an incredible captain, and they've got these great players. I personally think, yes, I personally think the U.S. is on, they're about to start dominating in a huge way, especially with all like the European stalwarts basically aging out of this thing.
Hey, is there a singular person you would credit with the task force?
It's tough. I think if you wanted to pick one person, it would be Davis Love. You know, he really, really has always cared about the Ryder Cup. He really did a good job in 2012 as captain and had this just wild Sunday miracle at Medina thing happen to him. And what that did was set everything back. He had taken a lot of the great ideas Paul Azinger had, who I think is like, if you're looking for somebody who is like our Tony Jacklin, the guy who first had some really, really profound good ideas about how to turn this around, it was Azinger. That was forgotten in 2010. Davis Love took a lot of his good ideas and was on the verge of a, you know, blowout Ryder Cup win, you know, leading 10-6 going into Sunday. That turns around. Then all of a sudden you get Ted Bishop at the PGA of America, who was like, these guys are soft. We need to do something dramatic, and gets, you know, Tom Watson in there, who is the worst captain America has ever had, to go blow things at Glen Eagles, which in turn, though, gives the U.S. permission, led by Davis Love, to sort of say, look, here's what we need to do. Here's what I think is going to work. And this task force is going to be big. Davis was big. Actually, Phil Mickelson was really big in it because he wanted things to change. Yeah. You know, what he did at Glen Eagles was actually probably pretty important. You know, I'm a huge Phil guy. No. And so, yeah. So like,
I thought that would be the answer. I thought like I was leading. I didn't want to lead you, but I think most people would say Phil, but you're really, you know, you've done the reporting here and DL3 is the guy.
In terms of publicly giving the U.S. leeway to transform things radically. Yeah. Phil played a huge role. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Davis Love. And then, you know, the guys who had been there forever, guys like Furyk, guys like Stricker, who had played in it and seen what had gone wrong. And then, yeah, like I said, going back to Azinger, like he's the one who laid the foundation for these ideas that are now seeing the U.S., you know, be really successful.
Nice. A question I have, this is off topic of your book, but kind of like the future of the Ryder Cup. It seems like we've got a little bit of a captain glut on it. On either side, there's different issues, you know, and obviously there's an interview. I can't remember exactly who was it. Zach Johnson talking about maybe there was in a recent tournament how they had a hole with Beth Page.
Davis.
Ryan picked up on that. He's the one who perceived that.
So, apologies, but Davis says that. And then on the European side, it seems like Liv is actually causing a real issue with captaincies.
It's funny on the European side, because before the Liv stuff, you're like, how are they all going to get in there to be captain? You've got like Poulter, Westwood, Rose, Sergio, on and on. There's like 12 guys. And you go, oh, they're literally all going to Saudi Arabia. So now it's like Rory's going to be playing captain or something. That's a big deal. I mean, Henrik, they delayed their captaincy pick forever this time, because it was supposed to be Henrik Stenson. It was a no-brainer. But it was all of a sudden, it was like, is he going to go to Saudi Arabia? And so Luke Donald was back in the mix. And I guess they must have gotten assurances from Stenson. But yeah, I think to what you said, the American side is the really interesting one of who they're grooming for this, because Zach Johnson is the one that was in the pipeline among like the sort of younger guys. He's going to be the captain of Italy. But then you've had like, you know, Davis is doing the President's Cup again. You've kind of had this cycle of sort of older guys. So I don't have an answer to your question, but the answer will be when they name their assistant captains for the President's Cup and for the Ryder Cup for the next two. Once you see those, whether it's Kuchar or whatever, like that's going to be the next guys.
Could be Ricky.
Could be Ricky, yeah.
While we're talking Liv and sort of structural sort of underpinnings of everything that's happening, I would say we're skeptical, not cynical, but we're a skeptical bunch. Is the PGA Tour now being involved with the European Tour via the Strategic Alliance? Are they going to try to get their fingers in this thing they've lusted and gazed at from afar? Like, oh my God, how do we get that? This thing like just spun up out of nowhere to become the biggest event of golf. Like they'd want the players. Is the tour going to get their fingers in this event via the other side of the Atlantic, the PGA Tour, and somehow, I don't know, I don't want to say negatively impact, but do you see them sort of getting involved here, getting a cut?
I think, you know, it's part of me roots for it because it's such a funny, clever way to go about things. You know, we've talked for years about, wow, the PGA of America was really lucky they kept the Ryder Cup. And it was just a fluke of history, right, that they did, because it was, again, nothing then. And so you always kind of focus on this American thing. And it's like, oh, no, they flanked them. they flanked them. They went to Europe. That, you know, actually, that's something I really should have thought of before, but haven't. If they got into the European side of the Ryder Cup, what would they do? How would things be different from a management angle? You would hope that it's like hands off, right? That, you know, the European Tour runs it for the European side right now. So if the European Tour is the PGA Tour at some point in the future, then the PGA Tour will run it. And that would be really interesting. I would love if they just like, you know, banned Americans from playing for the American team. Who knows? I don't think it would ruin the event at all. I think it would probably be pretty similar.
I don't think there'd be any substantive change. It's just people conspiracy theorists in the background.
I like it a lot.
Yeah. There's 100 meeting rooms at their global home in Ponte Vedra, and you got to figure the Ryder Cup's going to come up once or twice when you got that many meeting rooms and that many people.
People are going to talk.
I mean, they effectively tried to make their own Ryder Cup.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's
right.
Completely true. It is it is funny. Yeah, and the President's Cup may become popular at some point, like really on that Ryder Cup level. It's going to be years before that happens, but it's got to be tempting. Stick your finger in that Ryder Cup pie.
All right, let's get back to the book. I know we love banding about conspiracy theories. What was the writing process? How long? I know you've been like chronicling the Ryder Cup for various outlets, really. You know what? Since 2012, was that the first one?
Yeah, for Grantland.
Grantland, Medina, Grantland, right?
That was where you fell in love
with this event, right? Medina, or you've been watching it previously?
I've always loved the Ryder Cup. I think maybe the first memory I've had was Brookline, which was late in life. You know, that I would have been 16, late relatively, but I wasn't a golfer growing up. So, you know, for me to, I remember have memories of watching Brookline, how great that was. But yeah, 2012 was the first one I covered, and it was an amazing one to cover. And that definitely cemented, like, oh my God, like the romance of this event is incredible. And, you know, watching Poulter do what he did, that for sure, yeah, ironed it out in my head.
So for this book, The Cup They Couldn't Lose, what was the process like? When did you start writing it? Why did you decide the time frame you wanted to cover, the subjects you wanted to cover? How long did it take to write? What was the process?
Yeah, so I mean, we signed the deal in 2019. I'd always kind of wanted to write a Ryder Cup book, and I had intended to do it in 2016. And I was about to start writing a proposal when I found out that John Feinstein was writing a Ryder Cup book in 2016. I'm like, oh, I'm not going to compete with John Feinstein. That's silly. Yeah. So anyway, 2019, the first event I really covered was the President's Cup in terms of like this long path to Whistling Straits. It was just, you know, obviously it got delayed by the pandemic. So it was a lot of like looking at the history, the European history of the Ryder Cup, talking to guys who are going to be playing in this one, talking with people up at Whistling Straits. There were a lot of trips to Whistling Straits, trying to like establish a relationship with Pyrie Carrington and Steve Stricker, and, you know, doing the best I could with that. And, you know, you guys know it's like it's always such a pain to like try to get access to current players, to current personalities. And so a lot of it was just that annoying legwork to do that kind of stuff. I think probably the most interesting part of the process came after the Ryder Cup, when we wanted to get it out in the spring of this year. Like Feinstein's book came out a year later, which I thought was, I don't know if that was a tactical error, but it seems like a long time from the Ryder Cup to be getting the book out. Plus, nobody's thinking about golf in the fall, right? Everybody's thinking about it right now. This is sort of the peak season. I had to write the book in a month. And there wasn't that much that I could do beforehand, right? A lot depended, because your whole thesis is, wow, look, America's really good and they're paving the way. But then if you do all this work for that and they end up losing the Ryder Cup, you're like, oh, shit, like, what do I do? I had to do this. I had to write this book in a month and eventually got another week, right, from the publishers, who were great, by the way. It was like a 5-week process to write this 360-page book or whatever it is. It was definitely, I don't recommend it. It was really stressful, but in some ways I think good, because there was no time to think. It was just like every single day I rented an office, cause I couldn't be around, like I couldn't be home and focus. I rented an office, went in every day and just had to like grind out like 5,000, 6,000 words. It was insane. I don't think I could ever do it again in my life, but it was,
I can't remember the writer's name, but it might have been a movie, a guy that writes scripts for movies. But I heard that they go to a hotel and he won't leave the hotel room until the thing's written. So he could be there for 3 weeks. He could be there for 2 days. He just won't leave. Every meal is room service. That's his process. Like he goes to a place. I think he actually has them take TV out of the room, like there's distraction. It's amazing when you make yourself do it, and the ability of going to an office, how it like gets you away and makes it, that's the spot I write.
There was, I think 5 days in, I was already not on the pace that I needed to set. And so this was like a day where I was like, all right, we're going to do the entire Steve Stricker chapter where I talk about his whole life. You know, I went to visit Stricker's family. I covered like his whole thing growing up in Wisconsin. And I wrote this chapter, was really happy with it. It was about 6,000 words. And all of a sudden, my Microsoft Word screen turned to stars. This has never happened to me before. I have no idea what this is. But if you Google it, it's a real problem. And it's completely lost. I had not saved it at any point. And even if I did save it, I think I immediately tried to like autosave, which was the worst thing I could have done, because I'm just saving stars. And so there was definitely a moment there where it was like, you can see your life path veering off in two directions, where you either take this as a sign from a universe that you're doomed and like, just like, I'm not going to write this book ever. Or I immediately don't even like whine about it. Don't even complain beyond like a tweet on Twitter or something, like just immediately start writing again. And I did, I took that one, because it is a thing of like, you have to force yourself to do it. And the consequences of not doing it are like existentially terrifying. Like, oh, I had a book deal and didn't write a book. So there's no choice but to just like plow ahead.
Were you tolerable to your friends and family during this? Or were you just like not around enough to even be one way or the other?
I think I was okay. I definitely didn't speak with any friends, but I think with my family, I was all right, because it was nice at the end of the day to get home. But you know, actually I was probably a jerk. No, let me go back. I probably was short tempered for this month.
Was there an interviewee or subject of research that most surprised you in a good way or even a bad way, but like wow, that guy's got some joie de vivre, or he's got some takes. He's got some interesting background, like somebody who surprised you that thought might be a dial tone or might be a dud that really popped for your book.
You know, I'll give you two. One of them that everybody knows would be Tony Jacklin, right? I didn't realize how interesting and how funny and how good he was. And he's an older guy. He lives down in Florida.
Did you interview him in person?
Oh, yeah.
Or did you do it? Yeah, because it's hard. Yeah. He has some hearing issues, and it's hard to do it over a virtual.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I went down to Florida. This was just before the pandemic. Like, I caught him right between Bay Hill and the Players Championship. The player in 2020, right before everything went haywire. We sat in his club, and he talked to me for like 3 hours about his whole history as Ryder Cup captain, his history as a player. And yeah, he was just, he has a ton of joie de vivre, and he's had a crazy, interesting life. Financial difficulties, like, you know, his wife passed away in tragic circumstances when he was younger. His whole playing career is fascinating. He was the guy that finally won a major for the UK after like a 40-year drought. So he was this big pioneer figure. And then he lost to Lee Trevino at the Open Championship when Trevino chipped in on a hole, and is very open today. I think he was 28 years old, very open that it just destroyed him. Like, he felt like he blew that, and he was never the same after that. And he speaks honest, maybe because he's older, whatever, but he speaks so honestly about that stuff and about the Ryder Cup. So I absolutely loved interviewing him. Paul McGinley, I think, I got him the day before the pandemic hit at the Players Championship. Again, 3-hour conversation. Nobody is smarter than that guy about golf, I think, period, but especially about the Ryder Cup. And then the other guy, Dennis Tiziani, I don't know if you guys know that name, but he used to be the head coach at Wisconsin. And his daughter married Steve Stricker, and his son is Steve Stricker's agent. So, and he was Steve Stricker's coach for a long time. And so they're inextricably tied to the Stricker family. So anyway, you go up to Wisconsin and you see all these people, and they are like almost to a person exactly what you would imagine from like Lutheran Wisconsin people. Like, very, like, the funniest things was his parents, who were so nice to me. I was trying to get them going in conversation, and I had watched Stricker at the President's Cup. He has a very kind of observing personality. Like, he's always standing back watching things. And so I asked his parents, I was like, you know, what was he like as a kid? Cause this is what I saw at the President's Cup. Was he always somebody who was looking at everything and really kind of taking everything in? You know, what was he like? And they both look at each other and they go, I don't know. And then I asked them later in the interview, you know, describe his personality to me. And they're like, I don't really know. And you're like, wow, that's interesting, because I wouldn't expect that from parents. But it's not that they didn't know. It's just that there's like a, you know, there's a kind of wall in front of how they communicate. They're not like talkers. But anyway, Dennis Tiziani, this guy was one of the funniest people I met. And there's a ton with him in the book. He was full of like quotes by Lao Tzu. And then he, at one point, he was talking about Phil Mickelson. And he said to me, he's like, you know, look at Phil Mickelson. Why the fuck would you ever take this guy for a Ryder Cup team? And it just like saying things to me where I'm like, oh man, that's so interesting. and other little things like that, that you're like, you know, also I know he has Steve Stricker's ear. So when you look at things that happen later, like Mickelson not being on the team despite winning a major, yeah, there's 1,000 reasons for that. But you start to go back to these conversations and go, huh, if he's thinking that and he has such an influence, I wonder if Stricker was also thinking that. And so there's a lot of that little stuff, but he was a great person to talk to.
Was there any tidbits about Mickelson as an assistant captain? Obviously, this is, if you chart back the timeline of the last year, this is probably a time where there's a lot going on behind the scenes with Phil and maybe other agents and other agencies that have particular interests. And he's meanwhile, you know, kind of, in a way, snubbed. I don't know of any major champions that don't get the call, you know, especially just a few months earlier. Yep. And was there anything that was interesting that came out with Phil as the assistant captain?
You know, the funny thing is there wasn't. And that speaks, I think, to how effective Stricker was as a captain. Because like you said, like, the dude is, not only did he just win a major, but he's Phil Mickelson, right? I mean, like, his reputation precedes him and all that. Not only did Stricker smoothly not take him for the team, but when he became the assistant, everybody was like, oh, I wonder if Phil will actually run the team. You know, if his personality is so big that, look what he did at Glen Eagles, the revolution, like, I wonder if he's going to be the man controlling things. Stricker sidelined him so effectively. All this guy did at the Ryder Cup was walk by the crowds in his sunglasses and wave to people.
Wow.
You know, and he had his own little pod. He had his own little group that he was working with. But he just completely, Stricker nullified Phil Mickelson as a distracting force. And actually, he did the same with the Shambo Koepka feud, I thought, too. So, yeah, I think that was the most interesting thing about Phil, is that there was nothing interesting about Phil.
What about Thick Boy? He left the next day for
that's Bryson DeChambeau.
I figured that's
shorthand.
Yeah. My favorite is Thomas the Thirst Engine. I think that's like the most brilliant things you guys have done. But yeah. So Thick Boy,
chocolate milk. So
he headed out the next day for long drive. Is there any interesting anecdotes for the week of Bryson that you picked up on?
You know, just that obviously his huge drive on that one hole where Phil went nuts and was like chest bumping him. No, the thing, so much of the Ryder Cup is utilizing the people you have correctly and not letting it become this, you know, horrible distraction, not letting the worst sides of their personality dictate what happens. And again with Bryson, like, my answer is boring because Stricker was so good, right? Like, he somehow convinced Bryson that it was just fine, even though he's like this top level player. He's only going to play twice, you know, during the group stages, the pairs matches. And then he sends him out to play against Sergio on Sunday, and he drives the green on number one. And he was just like such an effective weapon, right? He won 2.5 points out of three matches with Scheffler on two of them. And yeah, I mean, it just like, I don't know. Again, it speaks to the job they did. So sorry, no drama, no intrigue. He was just like he was just himself there, just a good golfer.
You bring up Scheffler, and I think it's you know, something I thought about a lot when he won the Masters was the Ryder Cup. Yeah. And how big of a star he was in the Ryder Cup, and that Rahm, in particular, that Rahm singles match.
Yep.
Where Rahm's the hottest player in the world, no question, the best player in the world, and he's steamrolling Americans. Mm-hmm. And then he runs into Scottie Scheffler, which everybody at the time assumed was just a throwaway match.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because at the match play that year, Scheffler had beat Rahm, and he had beat Ian Poulter along the way to going to the finals and losing to Billy Horschel. And I texted Stricker after, saying like, you know, I'm writing something. Do you want to just comment on the fact that, you know, you've got two Americans in the finals? And he said, I love to see the Americans, especially Scottie Scheffler, who beat Rahm and Poulter, two of their big guys. Didn't mention Horschel at all, which again, interesting later when you consider that, you know, he didn't pick him. So that him beating Rahm was part of the reason he was on the Ryder Cup team. And then it was so poetic that you get this guy Scheffler, who was, if there was a controversial pick, it was him. I don't actually think it was that controversial, but he was the unexpected one, right? It was maybe they roll the dice with Patrick Reed to see if he's healthy, or maybe it's somebody else. He was the last guy picked. And not only do you pick him last, but he's, of course, very happy to play twice with Bryson DeChambeau, who might be a difficult guy to partner otherwise. He only plays twice, so he's well-rested. And then when that match was announced, I actually said on Twitter, this is like going to be some serious back padding here, but I actually said on Twitter, I think that's the match the Americans are most likely to win, because I was going back in history and looking at, for example, Rory at Hazeltine, where he did the same thing in a losing effort. Like, he was the engine. He was the man for the Europeans. And he expended all this energy playing all four sessions and was absolutely wiped out, right, for the match against Patrick Reed on Sunday, and Reed beat him. Justin Thomas was a similar thing in Melbourne at the President's Cup. He was the one who saved the U.S. when things looked really disastrous over the first 4 days. He was the only guy with any energy, and he was carrying America on his back, and he did an amazing job. Then Sunday came, and he lost in his singles match. He was one of the few Americans to have lost. Same exact formula. Like, I knew Rahm was going to be absolutely exhausted. He was playing Scheffler. And it did. It played out kind of just like I thought, where I forget, was Scheffler four up after four holes?
It was, yeah, five.
It was like five. It was like immediately over, right? It was just like there was no question who was going to win from the very start. And, Stricker didn't pick him. Stricker didn't know he was going to play Rahm on Sunday, but he did know he was going to be fresh, right? Because he had only played two matches. He did know he's like a killer in singles match play because he had shown it already that year. Obviously, he showed it again this year. And it just worked out like perfectly. Like, it was a brilliant strategy and then a great piece of luck to have him go against Rahm.
Something I'm discerning from your you think Stricker didn't really make any mistakes. My question is, was his biggest mistake not calling Billy Horschel to inform him that he wasn't on the team.
Billy was mad. Billy was not happy about that. He still hear about that, not getting a call.
But so I think Stricker's story was that he talked to him, and Horschel said, I know I'm not going to be picked, but I think you should pick, I can't even remember who it was, maybe Kevin Na or something. He's like, I know I'm not going to be picked, but I think, oh no, it was Sam Burns. That's who it was. He's like, I think you should pick Sam Burns. So Stricker interpreted that as Horschel knowing he wasn't on the team and thinking that he didn't need to call him. So I don't know. I mean, Horschel's hilarious. It's hilarious that he said that. I think he'd be a good Ryder Cupper, but I don't think Stricker was being malicious. I think he thought there was an understanding in place.
I think Billy Boy would actually be, he's a good away Ryder Cup player where they, you know, like if you think about players that would play well at Le Golf National, where the Paris massacre happened.
Yeah.
Billy Horschel is like a guy that thrives on that type of setup. And he'd be, you know, he'd be so into it. He would care more than anybody, probably care more than anybody wants anybody to care about it. Epic tantrums from him that week.
Yeah. Oh, he'd be great. Kisner would have been really great on that course. Yeah. It's one of those things where those are two guys where you're like, I hope before it's all over, they get a Ryder Cup. They probably won't at this point, but I hope they do.
Related to that, part of what makes the Ryder Cup has made it maybe the best event in golf are not necessarily like the Rahms or, I don't know, the number one ranked player in the world. It's like a guy like Poulter, right? Or a guy like Sergio before he had a major. Azinger was a thorn in the side. The guys that, like, basically when we talk about why the PGA Tour exists, this current, like, top-heavy money structure, the guys bringing the ratings, those aren't necessarily ones that have made the Ryder Cup must-see or given us the character and flavor that has made it such a great event. Do you feel like looking at the current landscape, you're so good at, like, reading between the lines of tea leaves, personalities, who might be those sort of antagonists? Those villains might be too strong a word for this next generation of Ryder Cups that sort of make it what it is. Like the guys that the other team does not like, the other fans do not like, but give it a ton of flavor and character.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's actually a big concern. I have memories of when Poulter was playing his first Ryder Cups and like had his spiked hair and just my stepfather, like just, you know, your average conservative golf fan, how much he hated him and Sergio. Yeah. And it's like, that's what does it. That's what makes the Ryder Cup so great. Like Poulter, you know, this would have been like 2004 or 2006 when they were just destroying us. Who is it like on the European side, especially anyone with passion. I mean, you're looking at guys like Matt Fitzpatrick, Tommy Fleetwood, some of the young guys, like
maybe a Hatton.
Yeah. Maybe Hatton. Like he got really fired up when he made his putt. After that, you start to, all we have to look at are older guys. Like the next would be like, you know, Shane Lowry and Rory, right? They're still vaguely youngish kind of. And then everybody else is leaving. All the guys that are the famously passionate Ryder Cup guys are on the way out. So I don't know. The truth is, I don't know some of the younger up and coming European guys enough to know who that's going to be. Like, I don't know what the Højgaards are like. You know what I mean? I don't know. I don't know what some of the young Italian golfers that everybody talks. I don't know what they're like yet because I haven't seen them and haven't, you know, so I hope there's somebody out there, but it also feels like we are in a global era of golf where uniqueness of personality declines with time. right. Like someone like Ian Poulter, Lee Westwood, they still kind of came up, like they're a little bit older than us. They still kind of came up in the pre, like everybody's like a global corporate product era. Like they still have some years like before the internet, you know, stuff like that. And so they're a little bit more unique. And, you know, maybe the answer is there's nobody like that. I hope that's not the case.
It feels like the Euros do not like Justin Thomas or did not like him, at least in this last Ryder Cup.
Well, he's constantly complaining about doing the thing where you hold up the putter, like of how long they made you putt. You know, like he's constantly doing things like that. He's incredibly intense. I did a story about the concession where Jack Nicklaus gave the putt to Tony Jacklin. Well, they played the WGC at the concession in 2020. Yeah, 2020. And I asked a lot of the players, you know, would you have done that? Would you have given that? And first of all, 80% of them had no idea what I was talking about, which is funny. Like John Rahm, to his credit, John Rahm was like, I hope I would do that. And he went to this whole historical diatribe. John Rahm really understands golf and the history of golf. But Justin Thomas was just like, he's like, I don't know what you're talking about, but no, I wouldn't have done it. in like the most flatline thing possible. So yeah, he was chugging the beer
on the tee too. I know that rubbed. So I, you
people
know, I
had, didn't like
I had
that
a conversation with with a player and mm-hmm. some caddies that did not appreciate that.
No, this source asked to not be named, but it was somebody on the European side who was. It was kind of funny. They were like, you know, if Arnie was here, would Arnie have done that? that was kind of their take. And so they didn't like that. Then he did, I don't know if you guys remember the weird thing at the Melbourne President's Cup where he did like the TO quote, like, I love me some me.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, that was like, for me, that was awkward. Like, I watching it, I'm like, I didn't dislike it on a sense of like, oh, you shouldn't showboat on the green, but it was kind of weird and made me sort of, I was just like, I wish he hadn't done that. That's weird.
I think that's the thing with some of JT's like antics that get me, you know, just like, you know, probably some of the origins of Thomas the Thirst Engine, but they just like, they don't look comfortable or natural when he does them. It looks like he's trying to put on a show. I don't know.
Well, like the thing with I Love Me Some Me, that had to be planned, right? Like, it's not just something that, like, that had to be in his head at some point. He's like, I know what I'm going to do if I make a big putt. Like this right, is going to blow minds when I do that. Next time I make a huge one. And he did it. And so.
Last one, and then we'll get you out of here. We've taken all your time here. You did a ton of research on the modern era, like what the modern processes. How much do statistics and analytics, like we know that's we know it's a massive part on both sides of the operation here, and maybe it wasn't for the U.S. at some points and not enough.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that threatens the Cup in a way to make it sort of too formulaic? We hear that about baseball a little bit, like it's sort of taken some of the excitement or character unpredictability out of the game, where it's just whatever, it's strikeouts and homers, things like that, shift. Do you feel like how much do statistics and analytics play in the operation on both sides, and do you feel like that could become a negative at any point?
Yeah, people already talk about that. You know, for this book, one of my favorite things I wrote was a chapter on like the numbers wars or the data wars, whatever you want to call it. And I talked to Jason Aquino, who runs this outfit called Scouts Consulting, which is they contract with the U.S. Ryder Cup team. They're actually going to do stuff with them for the President's Cup as well. And they have their opposite number, the 21st group in Europe. And they pour over the data. They analyze it like crazy. They can go so far as to say, here's where the optimal place is to put this tee on this hole based on the lineup you've got. Here are the players who would be really good together. And, you know, the captains listen to them a lot, but they also go their own way sometimes. Like, for example, the Morikawa-DJ pairing was something that the stats said, this probably won't work. And, you know, obviously it did really work. So it's not 100% thing, but they do use them in a lot of effective ways. And I think, to your question, it makes it really hard for a road Ryder Cup team to win, because the advantage that the home team has is that they can set up the course to their liking. That was a really inexact science before the stats guys came in. Now it's an exact science. And so it gives you, like, Paris was the ultimate example of, like, Jim Furyk was a good captain. Everybody respected him. He was following the template that has been so successful the last couple of years. And they set up this course and completely befuddled the Americans. They completely shocked them and they destroyed them, right? So, yeah, I think people are talking about that. People are going so far as to talk about maybe we shouldn't let the home team set up the course at all. Maybe it should be a neutral, like, you know, the PGA of America and the European Tour working together to determine what this course is going to look like. So that conversation is being had. Personally, I think it's a cool element. I think, like, yeah, let's make it really hard to win on the road. I think that's fun. But we've now had, what, three blowouts at home in a row. And if you go back to 2006, all but Medina have been home blowouts. And so, yeah, if you go 10 more years with no drama, that might be something that people do.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Well, that sounds like you got a great chapter in there on that. Aquino, the Scouts guy. So you kind of hit this from all angles. So we appreciate the time. Again, what's the name of the book?
The Cup They Couldn't Lose. It has a long subtitle. I'm embarrassed. I actually don't know. No, The Cup They Couldn't Lose. It's like, I think it's, oh, here we go. The Cup They Couldn't Lose.
I love that.
The Cup They Couldn't Lose, America, the Ryder Cup, and the Long Road to Whistling Straits. So there you go.
All right. Amazing. Amazing. Thank you so much for your time. That's available Tuesday, May 10th, but you can pre-order it at your major bookstores or the indie bookstores. We hear they'll be
on shelves walk everywhere. Into your indie yeah.
walk into any indie bookstore
and demand that they get this book.
Put some
that's,
granola.
That's a pre-order. There's a pre-order.
That,
right
that
there.
Is how you pre-order the analog way. That's right.
Put a little granola in your backpack, head out to the local indie shop and find the cup that can lose. Shane, thank you so much for the time. We'll continue reading your work elsewhere, but for now, we're excited to get our hands on the cup they couldn't lose.
Thank you guys so much. This was fun.